Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to look at Stalinist deportation and exile in the 1930s in the Soviet Union. Now, of course, in Russia, deportation and exile were nothing new after 1917. These had been tools employed by the Tsarist regime, and Lenin saw no reason why they shouldn't be used by the Bolsheviks after they seized power. Lenin, in his book State and Revolution, written in 1917, argued that the state would need to retain its repressive power. Lenin had been responding to arguments by Nikolai Bukharin that the state would need to be dissolved in the interests of the working classes and the interests of working towards a communist future in Russia, and that the state was really a mechanism by which class repression, could be effectively doled out. And Lenin said, yes, it is, but we need to do a different kind of class repression. We need to repress enemy classes. And the revolution won't be easy, it won't be simple, and there will be all manner of individuals trying to undo the state, trying to undo the new Bolshevik state. So we need to retain as much of the apparatus of repression as possible. And one of the most potent tools of repression was administrative exile. Exile was used for members of the left opposition, the likes of Leon Trotsky, people with bad class origins, former landowners, and the counter-revolutionary classes that we've talked about recently. But by far the biggest group who faced exile were the kulaks. The kulaks in the mass deportations of 1930 to 1931 were removed in huge numbers. Some 400,000 households, or roughly just over 2 million individuals, were uprooted and moved out of Ukraine and parts of rural Russia. But as ever, defining who the kulaks were and who should be identified and targeted for removal was quite difficult. It was quite difficult if you cared enough about actually arresting the right people. In the arbitrary way that it was actually carried out, it wasn't much of an issue at all for the Soviet regime. The kulaks were regarded by the regime as class exploiters in the countryside. They had been the product of Stolypin's land reforms in the first decade of the 20th century, and they were often the product of their wealth, was often the product of better education, of better understandings of farming practices, harder work and less drinking. Now, to refer to it as wealth as well is to rather misunderstand the situation. They rarely did kulaks stand out in a village as being significantly wealthy. There were those who were mildly more prosperous than their neighbours and had a bit more land. Those who had managed to acquire land during the revolution by seizing landlord estates were waiting during the era of the provisional government and also the era of the Bolsheviks for the government to give the nod to authorise, to make legal this land acquisition, because they were well aware that in the past when lands have been seized they can always be handed back to the landowners. So the kulaks were often not the reviled figures in the villages that the regime tried to present them as, but often highly useful people to know, people who could lend money, who could supply work, people who had surpluses of food in times of dearth, and people who simply represented part of the kind of the village ecosystem. There was a great deal of political capital, the Bolsheviks knew, in appealing to the poor peasants in villages and whipping up hatred against the kulaks. And there was an attempt to really create a kind of a grassroots movement against the kulaks during the period of the Great Famines. So the added complication was that often the person who was the kulak in the village changed. People's fortunes differed. Some families became wealthier, some became poorer, particularly as a result of the revolution. In 1929, Stalin commences the de-kulakization campaign, where he called for the liquidization of the kulaks as a class. Now, today, of course, we're looking at Sheila Fitzpatrick and everyday Stalinism. She writes, "Peasants identified as kulaks were stripped of their land, animals and equipment and evicted from their homes. Many of the victims were deported to distant regions of the country by the OGPU. Formal criteria rarely counted for anything. What mattered was who local officials and the incoming collectivization activists thought was a kulak. The activists would come from towns and cities and be party members. It was who they assumed was a kulak. Often this meant prosperous peasants, especially those who had been village leaders, not particularly well disposed towards Soviet power. But troublemakers of all kinds were also greatly at risk. Someone who was unpopular in the village, for whatever reason, might find himself branded a kulak. Where villages were ethnically or religiously divided, for example, between Russians and Ukrainians or Orthodox and Old Believers, one ethnic or religious group might manage to pin the kulak label on the other." So often when repressive state power meets the complexities of social relations, that power can be subverted, abused, manipulated and co-opted by individuals to their own ends, as we've seen in looking at Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Denunciations often serve private purposes, wives getting rid of errant husbands and people taking revenge for slights in the workplace with terrifying consequences. So the kulak label was a powerful weapon to wield against people that a Russian peasant didn't like. Sheila Fitzpatrick points out that even communists were uneasy with the growth in the category of kulak during de-kulakization. It was unsystematic. There were far more people being dumped into the title of kulak than could possibly actually justifiably have been kulaks based on Bolshevik logic alone. And the new categories began to be made, such as kulaks hireling, which described a person who deserved a kulak's fate but couldn't quite be referred to as a kulak in economic terms. When de-kulakization had taken place, when people were removed from their kulak status. They had their wealth taken from them, they had their status taken from them and their citizenship. The word kulak was not taken. It was something that would follow them around for the rest of their lives. They would be referred to as a former kulak. And this term was something that aroused suspicion and animosity in party members and Soviet citizens in general. It had become easier to identify kulaks by giving them this title, those that had been through the process of being accused of being kulaks and then having their wealth appropriated from them. In another way, it was more difficult because many peasants, potentially in the kulak group, had run away rather than wait to be arrested. So those who were identified, those who had been arrested and had been deported and had been labelled as kulaks and had been then labelled as former kulaks, they could be identified and stigmatised for life. But the process of de-kulakisation made so many peasants try to escape their fate and tried to run away and hide, but actually identifying those was entirely was highly difficult. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "These people were now in the process of masking themselves and assuming new social identities. That was why it was so vital to the regime to identify and expel them in the process of introducing passports in the cities. But of course, many hidden kulaks, even more children of kulaks, who might be expected to share their parents' bitterness, still eluded the authorities. New stigmas fell on the deportees who were sent to the far north, to the Arctic, to the Ural Mountains, to Siberia and the Far East, and were sent either as labourers on sites such as Magnitogorsk, which was a little more than a tent city initially, or were sent as as peasants to work on uncultivated land in Siberia, the kind of land clearance where normally the land was wholly unsuitable to the kind of farming the peasants knew, and would later be rolled out under Khrushchev and in a greater way as the kind of the Virgin Lands campaign, with fairly dismal results. Deportation was not a judicial sentence, it was an administrative punishment. And so that meant that no court convicted the kulaks. It was simply the kind of the whim of government policy that people were moved because they were seen as bad. And it was an executive action in the defence of society. This is the way it's framed. And the reason why this is problematic, particularly in the Soviet Union, is that there is no start and end date with a prison sentence. There is some indication that the sentence will end. Though in point of fact, the Soviet prison system and the Gulag system during the 1920s and 30s is so chaotic, there are some prisoners who their release dates are simply forgotten and they are set to work permanently. Kulaks who were deported existed in a kind of a legal black hole. They existed as an entirely separate part of the population that were not convicted of any crime, but certainly experienced a loss of rights and had special conditions placed upon them. They were initially referred to as special settlers, which was later changed to the term labour settler, which was far more descriptive of what they were actually being sent away to do.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
In a couple of years, the Kulaks were joined by other groups who had been released from the Gulag. They had served their sentence in the Gulag, and that they were not allowed to return home. They were sent into exile, where the state could keep an eye on them and potentially rearrest them if necessary. These were often former enemy classes, former landlords, capitalist business owners from prior to the revolution, and who the OGPU did not wish to return to their hometowns. In a way, one of the key reasons for that was to control knowledge of the Gulag, to keep those who had experienced it in one place and as far away from the mainstream of Russian society as possible. The term of exile had no limitation. There was some confusion about what the regime actually intended on this. The regime itself didn't quite know about how long the Kulaks should be sent away. Deportees were not issued with passports when the when internal passports are introduced. A government decree of 1934 returned civil rights to them, including the right to vote, but these were only returned to those who demonstrated their ability to be worthy through what was referred to as socially useful labour. Civil rights included normally the right to mobility, but in January 1935, at the request of Yagoda, the head of the NKVD, Stalin refused to grant this to the deported Kulaks. So the deported Kulaks were unable to move from where they had been sent to. A public clarification on this question, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, appeared a week later. Even so, there were hints at a Kolkhoz Congress in the spring that at least one party leader remained doubtful. Despite this, deportees still hoped to return home. When the new constitution of 1936 was announced, many read it as an amnesty and petitioned for release, but in vain. Many others fled from exile over the years, more than 600,000 between 1932 and 1940, according to the Russian historian, of whom two-thirds, over 400,000, were successful. The number of deported Kulaks and family members still living in exile as of October 1st, 1941, was under 900,000. During World War II, there were further departures. Many of the male deportees were called up for military service, which generally meant that their family exile was lifted. It was not until after Stalin's death that all the Kulaks deported more than 20 years earlier were formally released. Kulaks lived in special settlements. Those who worked in industry, which was about half of them, had conditions that were not particularly different from those who were considered to be free labour. Not that that was particularly worth writing home about, as working conditions across the Soviet Union during the 1930s are fairly bad in the best of circumstances. The exiles, however, are ineligible to join trade unions. And in 1938, The NKVD, as it was then, taking it from the OGPU, took 5% of wages from wage-earning exiles in order to pay for the cost of their exile, for administering it. And obviously there's a great deal of corruption and graft and embezzlement as a result. The deported kulaks did get their right to vote back, but this was subject to good behaviour. And at the beginning of 1935, this was confirmed, but the kulaks were under no illusions that really this could be removed at any time, and it really did depend on how they voted and who they voted for. Until 1938, the children of special settlers shared some of the restrictions that were placed upon their parents, particularly as it regarded to freedom of movement. They did have a right to education, and they were accepted for admission to higher educational institutions outside their place of settlement. They were could in theory be issued with passports and allowed to leave, at which point they ceased to belong to the category of special settlers. From autumn of 1938 onwards, all children of special settlers became eligible for passports at the age of 16 and were then free to leave the settlement. This obviously has a significant impact in breaking up what the kulak family. Often children who left the special settlements never returned or didn't see their families again. As we know, the majority of special settlers who were deported were kulaks, but there were other collective deportations, but on a smaller scale. The ethnic deportations that began in the middle of the 1930s and the Leningrad deportations that followed the murder of Kirov in December 1934 are two particular examples of that. So let's talk about the ethnic deportations. The ethnic deportations were a kind of an outlier in Soviet policy. Stalin, as Commissar for Nationalities, and Lenin before him, had attempted to present the Soviet regime as one that believed in decentralization, believed in the aspirations of nationalities to become self-governing, and the national identity of everywhere from Georgia to Ukraine to Kazakhstan to Belarus. All these ethnicities were encouraged to kind of assert themselves, these national identities. And the diaspora peoples of the Soviet Union, the Finns, the Koreans, were treated as prime targets for deportation, highly suspect in the eyes of Stalin, and were far more likely to face transportation in order to actually break up national identity, to break up ethnic unity, to break up ethnic cohesion and national politics. They were transported in much the same way as the kulaks were and resettled in the interior. Ethnic deportations foreshadowed more high profile ones during the war, such as the Volga Germans or the Chechens, and the deportations were largely unpublicised within the Soviet Union, but the practice of ethnic deportation was known well enough, at least in the Leningrad region, for, and this is from Fitzpatrick, for a man with a Finnish name to refuse to respond to a census taker in 1939 with the comment, "I know why you were taking a census of the population. This is done in order to find out the Finns from the Estonians and then deport them." Following the assassination of Kirov in 1934, the majority of those arrested and deported were the former people, the former aristocracy, the former bourgeoisie, the former Tsarist administrators who had survived the revolution and managed to hang on in Leningrad bit by bit. It was used as a great opportunity to round up all those who hadn't already been caught by the kind of the dragnet of totalitarian power in the Soviet Union and deport them. Fitzpatrick writes, both these categories were held to have some responsibility for the murder. Indeed, a number of oppositionists were executed for the crime, including Zinoviev and Kamenev in the first Moscow trials of 1936, although there's no concrete evidence of their involvement, and it is even possible that the timing of the deportations was partly coincidental. The decision to send 2,000 former communists from Leningrad into provincial exile was presented in internal documents as an outcome of the recent party purge. The exile of over 1,000 Leningrad former people was described in a brief official announcement as a punishment for violating residence regulations and the passport law. The popular conclusion of the action, however, was that it was a case of rounding up the usual suspects after Kirov's murder. It was even rumoured that the NKVD had compiled its list from the Leningrad City Directory, in whose pre-revolutionary volumes well-worn citizens had habitually identified themselves by estate and service rank. She concludes by saying, among those expelled from Leningrad were former Baron Tipolt, who had got himself a job in an industrial meal service as an accountant, General Tufasev, who was a teacher of geography, and former police chief Komendatov, who was a technician at a factory, and General Spassky, who was a cigarette seller in a kiosk. But some less exalted individuals got pulled into the net, like the man who'd worked as a scribe in the Tsarist Ministry of Justice, whose deportation order was cancelled only after 4 years petitioning. So the use of deportation as a tool, which was used to target particular political dissidents under the Tsarist regime, becomes a mass social tool, a way of the regime waging class warfare against the kulaks, and also socially purging cities like Leningrad, and of waging warfare against what Stalin viewed as kind of dangerous revisionist ethnic separatism. Okay, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do pop by our Patreon page if you can help fund the podcast. Obviously, we're reliant on a trickle of ad revenue and the generosity of our listeners. Thanks so much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.